The Irish struck out across America's frontiers. They built its railroads, policed the nation's streets, set up its banks, educated its masses. I could go on and on about what the Irish did in America, but we're going to open up a new book now which documents 50 Irish people who made an indelible mark on American society. It's called Irish Lives in America. It's the latest in a series from the Royal Irish Academy, which collects together life stories from the Dictionary of Irish Biography. Joining me to discuss some of the extraordinary people profiled in the book are the editors Liz Evers and Niamh Gallagher, and you're very welcome indeed. Now, you come from very different research backgrounds, very different areas. Liz, how did the idea for the book come about? How did you choose who should feature in the book? Because you've had, you have a wide, wide potential choice.
Well, I think the inspiration to kind of get us on the road was Donald Trump, of course.
we both became very inspiring man.
Yeah, we both became fairly obsessively interested in American politics along with the rest of the country during his presidency. And I suppose there was a couple of things that stood out there. The first was the really virulent anti-immigration stance that got him into power and then the policies thereafter. And then there was the number of Irish surnames swirling around in his orbit. So whether they were politicians or pundits or, you know, people that he was appointing, I suppose it just got us kind of thinking about the contrast there of, it was so obvious to us as Irish people that he was surrounded by people of Irish descent who were, you know, immigrants who were treated as poorly as they were currently treating the next tranche of immigrants. And so we wanted to sort of dig around in the dictionary and see what the past could tell us about the situation that we were in and kind of the birth of the Irish American identity as such.
Niamh, you're a medievalist. There weren't too many medieval or people from the Middle Ages, Irish people or otherwise, who ended up in America.
No, but I mean, I was brought into the dictionary not just to write about medieval history. The latest tranche that we published just recently, I was writing about Billy Barry, was one of them, Ian McKeever, the mountaineer. So, you know, I have written about medieval people for the dictionary, but, you know, I'm a trained historian.
Indeed. You've got to be able to turn your hands to anything.
In actual fact, no, it's wonderful to be able to work with modern sources because I'm used to, well, my husband would say making stuff up as I go along.
Reading stuff off stones,
yeah. Obviously. Yeah, no, but reading Latin and, you know, trying to dig around and ferret in archives and libraries for little bits of information. So it's lovely to be able to work with a much broader range of material.
Now, I think there were something like 500 names of people who were born in Ireland but died in America in the Dictionary of Irish Biography. So presumably you confined yourself, there could be many, many more you could have chosen, but you confined yourself to those, but you had to narrow it down to 50. I mean, that must have killed you.
It was very hard. We started off with, as you say, 500, and we whittled it down to about 115, was it, Liz?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, what the two of us did was we went through them and we picked out our favourites. And we obviously had to exclude anybody who wasn't born in Ireland. We excluded people that just weren't interesting. Mm. You know, they lived relatively mundane lives.
And you seem also to have excluded, and I don't blame you for this, I think you were dead right, to have excluded people who had more relevance to Irish history than they did to American history.
Yeah.
John Devoy, for example. And I was actually
going to use Devoy as an example. We put in John Boyle O'Reilly because his contribution was to Irish America, but it was also to America. You know, he was such a passionate advocate for equal rights and civil rights. So it was really, yes, we wanted them to have made their mark on American society, not just the Irish aspect of the Irish in America.
So you run the gamut from 1670 until 2015. And 2015 is somebody particularly interesting, somebody I had the great pleasure of interviewing myself a number of years back, Maureen O'Hara.
Yes, Maureen O'Hara. So, yeah, so she kind of brings us almost up to date, even though I suppose her career heights were in the 40s and 50s, but she's such a well-known figure. So we had a wealth of Irish actors to choose from. And again, as part of the selection process, we were trying to find people who were representative of larger groups, because we do have an awful lot of Irish entertainers who went over. So Barry Fitzgerald would have been on the shortlist.
Arthur Shields
was on the shortlist. Sarah Allgood was on the shortlist. But in the end, we chose Maureen and we chose Geraldine Fitzgerald as well as another Irish actress.
Two very different actors.
Yeah, and it's interesting because they have so much that's kind of in common in terms of their background. And there was only, I think, 7 years between them, Fitzgerald being the older of the two. And they were both born into kind of well-to-do families outside of Dublin. And they both started in the theatre in Dublin. But Maureen kind of got discovered that bit earlier. So she didn't get to have the theatrical career to start off with. So she was straight into the movies. She started off with a couple of good movies, but then she was into the studio system and having to star in whatever she was told to star in. And she was a bit bitter about that because she would have liked to have been an actress in the European style and be that kind of, have the juicier roles and maybe, you know, dabble more in theatre, which is exactly what Geraldine Fitzgerald got to do. And she was very forthright in demanding in her contract when she did eventually move to Hollywood after a good long, substantial theatrical career to start off with, that she would have a contract that for 6 months of the year she'd be off doing theatre, which is very unusual because we know they were very strict, the contracts that the Hollywood actors used to get. So, yeah, they had very different careers, but Maureen is still the better known, I suppose, of the two. Mm. But she would have preferred to have a kind of a better quality of, maybe not be known as the swashbuckling beauty, but to have been appreciated for her acting prowess a little bit more. But she is very much appreciated here in Ireland.
Still did get some incredible roles, there's no doubt about it. Niamh also specially commissioned a biography of somebody called Albert Cashier. Now, Albert Cashier is somebody I came across a number of years ago and thought that he was unique, but discovered that he was anything but unique. Yeah. There were a number of people like Cashier. What's so interesting?
Well, Albert's story is both very ordinary and very extraordinary. I mean, Albert represents those Irish who travelled across dirt poor, illiterate. He joined the army. He lived, you know, a relatively quiet life. He worked in a small town in Illinois and he died. But what was extraordinary about Albert is that he was born Jenny Hodgers. And from an early age, we think that his stepfather dressed him as a boy and sent him out to work. And when he travelled to America, he travelled as Albert and he lived his whole life as Albert. And it was only discovered towards the end of his life when he was run over by a car and his leg was broken. It was only discovered that he had actually been born female. And Albert is representative, we think, of about 400 women who fought in the Civil War for America. And, I mean, the reasons that they fought were multitudinous. You know, they might have fought because they followed a lover. They might have fought because they passionately believed in the cause. They might have fought because they wanted adventure. You know, there was numerous reasons. And people will say, well, how come they didn't get discovered? You say, well, the uniforms, they weren't tailor-made. They were shapeless. It was, you know, the middle of the 19th century. People were very prudish in their personal habits. So you wouldn't necessarily ever be uncovered as a female unless you were injured or captured.
I'd love to know how many of them went back to being female after the American Civil War. Has anybody done any research into that?
Yeah, not that I'm aware of. I'm sure there has been, but I haven't read it. I would love to see that as well.
It'd be very interesting. Obviously, it didn't happen with Jenny Hodgers stroke Albert Cashier.
Well, no, I mean, poor Albert, after he was injured, he went to the veterans' home where he continued to live as Albert. But when he went senile, he was sent to the local insane asylum. They forced him to wear a dress. And of course, he was confused. He was upset and he tried to fashion it into trousers and fell and broke his hip. And that eventually killed him because it got infected.
And somebody else who was female who lived in a man's world, and you wrote about as well, and that was Anne Bonny. Tell us about Anne Bonny, an American, Irish-American grand-mère.
An Irish-American grand-mère, indeed. Anne Bonny, there's an awful lot of myth built around Anne Bonny, and she's been subject to, is it graphic novels and TV programmes recently, Liz?
Yeah, she's been in a few, all right.
She has, hasn't she? And most of what we have from Anne Bonny comes from the writings of a Captain Charles Johnson, who is purported to be actually Daniel Defoe. And he wrote that Anne Bonny travelled, was born about 1700, travelled across to America with her father to the South Carolinas, where he became a plantation owner, very wealthy background, and then travelled to the Bahamas, where she took up with a rogue called Calico Jack. And she and Mary Read travelled with Calico Jack and his pirate crew raiding off the coast of Hispaniola and Cuba. And the crew was captured in about 1720, and all the males were tried, they were found guilty and they were hanged. But the ladies, first off, pleaded not guilty, and the witnesses said, listen, they had machetes, they had pistols. They were the last ones to be captured.
That was for the cooking.
It was, yeah. They needed the machetes for the cooking and the pistols for the chickens that escaped. And they were dressed as piratical men. And of course, when they were captured and they pleaded not guilty, the witnesses came forward saying, listen, this is all rubbish, obviously. So then the ladies changed their tune and they both pleaded their belly, which meant that they said they were pregnant. And unusually enough, actually, it turned out that they both were. Normally, when women pleaded their belly, they were just trying to buy themselves some time. And that's really where the story of Anne Bonny, as we know it, ends. Because Mary Read died in prison, but Anne Bonny, all Captain Charles Johnson says, is that's the last we hear of her. Whereas the story has gone on to be that her father swept in and saved her from the prison, and she married respectably and she lived into old age and, you know, turned her back on her pirate ways. But we can't actually say.
Hope she did not live into respectable
old age. I hope she lived, she died very
but
unrespectably.
Not into, yeah, absolutely. Liz, the book is broken into themes, including literature, art, business. Tell me about Mary Ann Sadler and the contribution that she made to American life.
Yeah, she is one of those people who was more focused on the Irish in America than contributing to the sort of broader life in America. So she's one of the exceptions to our rule. But she's a really interesting figure because of, in my mind anyway, how she helped develop the sort of idea of the Irish American, the Catholic Irish American in the middle of the 19th century. So she was a very pious woman and a very prolific writer. And she married James Sadlier, who was the one half of the biggest Catholic publisher in America at the time, based in New York. And she ended up providing quite a lot of their content for them. So she published various novels, and a lot of them were focused around, you know, the Irish emigrant to America, and usually very devout Irish emigrant to America, and how they might kind of protect themselves from the corrupting forces of Protestantism and capitalism, and, you know, keep their virtue intact and, you know, do what their mammy would like them to do, etc. So this went down a storm with the new waves of immigrants coming over from Ireland, because obviously they were novels in which they saw themselves reflected to an extent. But she was also the first writer to ever write a fictional depiction of the famine as well. Now, she had left Ireland in 1840, so she wasn't there for the worst years, but obviously she would have encountered an awful lot of people coming into America escaping the famine. That's where she would have got, obviously, first-hand accounts. So that was the first representation in fiction of the famine, and also superism. So that would have been the main source of information, I think, for a lot of Irish Americans who were already in America, of the famine as well. So in terms of that creation of this Irish American identity, which we all associate with that famine generation now more so, and it being a very Catholic identity, obviously that wasn't the only version of Irish American identity, but it's kind of become our go-to, and she definitely helped create that.
It's great, by the way, that you have included so many women in the book, because after the famine, 50% of the Irish who migrated to America were female.
Yeah.
And somebody else is very important, a figure in the literary world, a woman who's responsible for some of the greatest poetry ever written. So why have we never heard of Margaret Marr before?
Well, because she didn't write the poetry to start off with.
There is that.
Yeah. No, and actually it's great to have Margaret Marr in this collection, because with the Dictionary of Irish Biography, the nature of it is that people are in there because they're usually quite notable for something, some achievement of theirs. Margaret Marr is one of the few people that we have who's just an ordinary person. She was a domestic servant. She just happened to get herself into an extraordinary situation. So she migrated over from Tipperary when she was about 20, I think, and she moved to Amherst, Massachusetts, and ended up working for the Dickinson family.
I think people can probably see where this is going.
Yeah.
Go on.
So she worked for the Dickinson family, Emily Dickinson being the daughter of the family, and she was with them for about 30 years, and she would have been very close to Emily. And I believe Emily actually used to put her finished poems into Margaret's trunk and save them in her trunk. So when Emily was getting close to death, apparently she asked Margaret to burn the poems. She didn't want them out in the world anymore. And the story goes that Margaret decided that she wasn't going to do that, and she kind of kept them for posterity. And she also kept the only image that we have of Emily Dickinson as an adult that was also meant to be destroyed. So without Margaret deciding to disobey her orders, And apparently she was that kind of woman. She was feisty and she didn't take any crap from anyone. And so, yeah, without her deciding to do that, we wouldn't have the literary figure of Emily Dickinson.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah. Good for her. Niamh, some of those included in the book make a positive contribution mm-hmm. to American society. One in particular, Margaret Hoary, one of the first women to be commemorated with a statue, of
yeah,
all things.
That's right.
And that's in New Orleans. Why did she deserve a statue?
Well, Margaret, I suppose like Margaret Moore, who was an ordinary person, Margaret Hoary is kind of representative of an ordinary person leading an extraordinary life. Her tale is one that would be quite common in that she stayed behind in Ireland while her parents went over to America and then followed on when she was a little bit older. And her younger sister died almost immediately when they landed after a 6-month sea voyage. And then her parents died in the yellow fever pandemic of 1822. And she was left alone. She was 9 years old and she was illiterate and she was taken in as a domestic servant. And then it seemed that things were getting better. She married and she moved to New Orleans with her husband and her infant child, and they both died. And, you know, at that stage, she could have crumbled. She could have given up and she could have thrown herself upon the mercy of the world. But instead, she went to live with the Sisters of Charity. And in return for food and lodging, she worked. And she bought a cow with money that she borrowed, and she used the milk to feed the orphans that the nuns were looking after. And with the excess, she sold it and used the money to buy more cows and eventually owned a dairy and then sold the dairy and bought a bakery and fed most of New Orleans at one stage or another. She opened soup kitchens, she built orphanages. When the Civil War was on, she travelled through enemy lines and she fed both sides of the army. So Margaret, when she died, the town so respected her that the newspapers edged their papers in black, and the archbishop, the governor of Louisiana and the mayor of New Orleans were actually her pallbearers. And after she died, the town clubbed together and erected a statue, which was, is it the first publicly paid for statues, I think, of a woman. It's definitely the first one of a philanthropist, and it's probably the only one of a baker.
Richly, richly deserved. Now, the Irish being the Irish, not every character in this book is a paragon of virtue. And there's one particularly villainous one who left an extraordinarily negative legacy, a kind of a Simon Legree, an Irish Simon Legree. Tell us about Pierce Butler.
Well, you know, when we were writing the book or putting it together, we didn't want to represent just virtuous Ireland or amazing Ireland. We wanted to represent Ireland and the rich tapestry that is. And, you know, I mean, the people going over, some of them were very ordinary, some of them were extraordinary. And Pierce just happens to be the most unpleasant example of a certain type of gentleman. He was a younger son of a baronet, which meant that he was never destined to inherit his father's lands. What I find extraordinary, actually, is that he was a lieutenant, a full lieutenant in the army by the age of 14, commanding troops against the French Canadians for the British Army. I mean, at the age of 14, I mean, I wouldn't trust my child with the remote control. So it seems extraordinary. And he continued to fight with the British Army. And in actual fact, his regiment fired the first shot of the Boston Massacre in 1770. But by the time the American Revolution proper got underway, he was siding with the rebels. And that's because Pierce had married a South Carolina heiress and was now a huge landowner and slave owner. And one of Pierce's grimmest contributions to American history is the insertion of the runaway slave clause into the Constitution. He was one of the delegates there in Philadelphia at the convention, and he insisted on the runaway slave clause, which was that slaves were property and had to be returned, even if they crossed into free states. And so proud legacy.
And I'm sure he made some contribution to slaves being categorised as three quarters of a human being.
Yeah,
exactly. Liz, let's move to my favourite part of America. Let's go west, right? And the frontier. Mm. Now, the frontier obviously kept moving. The frontier in the 18th century was very different to the frontier in the 19th century. And one of the people that you have included, and I think this is fantastic, great idea, because not many people know, I think it's about 4 years. If Andrew Jackson had been born, 4 or 5 years earlier, he'd have been Irish and he could never have been American president. but his mother was Irish.
She was from Antrim, and herself and her husband decided to go over to America, following pretty much everyone from their neighbourhood. It was around the time that there was mass migrations out of Ulster. So herself and the husband went over. They were a bit later than, say, some family members and other people from their townlands. And so they didn't get the best choice of land. So when they arrived over there, they had a couple of very wooded, very heavily wooded acres to work with. And it basically killed the husband, whose name was Andrew Jackson as well. So then Elizabeth Jackson was left in this area. It's called the Waxhaws in South Carolina, which was very much a kind of an Ulster stronghold from the sort of the mid 18th century. So anyway, she was left without the husband, and she had two kids, and she was pregnant with her third, which was Andrew. She ended up having to move in with her sister, who was semi-invalid, so she was looking after the sister's family as well. So life was far from ideal. And then the first stirrings of revolution. So her teenage sons, in fact, the three of them, because Andrew then would have been about 13 or 14, the three of them went off to kind of fight on the American side. So rather than being supportive of the colonial powers, unfortunately, then one of her sons was killed. And then Elizabeth, who was quite a formidable woman anyway, she decided she was going to go and get her other two sons. She heard they were being held in a camp and that they had smallpox, I think. She went off to retrieve them, and she managed to do a kind of a prisoner swap type situation. And she brought her two sons home, and the elder one died a couple of days after arriving home. And so then Andrew, she nursed him back to health, and then she went off again to retrieve her nephews, who were a bit further afield. So she set off on a 160-mile journey to get them, and unfortunately she never came home. She herself died of a fever.
She'd have been better off in Antrim.
She would have been a lot better off in Antrim, and I think they were actually quite reasonably well-to-do family in Antrim, so it wasn't It wasn't a great move for them. But yeah, Andrew Jackson was then orphaned at the age of 14, so the whole family gone.
And went on to become Donald Trump's favourite president. Other than Donald
yes.
Trump, because obviously Donald
yes.
Trump is Donald Trump.
So there
Trump's.
You go, the saintly Irish yep. caricature is it's undermined
tarnished.
Again. Yeah.
One of the things, Niamh, that always annoys me about depiction of the West in American, in Hollywood,
yeah.
that you, with the exception of colour sergeants in cavalry regiments, you never hear a single Irish accent.
No.
And there should have been many, many Irish accents.
Yeah.
And one of them, probably, I mean, to me, the most important Irishman who ever migrated to the American West would have had a thick Cavan accent.
Thick Cavan accent, Thomas Fitzpatrick, who's absolutely fabulous. I mean, as you said, I grew up watching Westerns with Clint Eastwood and a cheroot clamped between his lips and a poncho
slung.
Well,
you wouldn't know what his accent was because he never spoke.
Well, he mumbled manfully, yeah. didn't he? But I don't imagine Thomas Fitzpatrick actually mumbled manfully. I'd say
Or smoked a cheroot,
no. But, I mean, he's one of the greatest mountain men, and yes, very few people know anything about him. I mean, he travelled with Jedediah Smith. He was one of the first to open up the South Pass through the Rockies. He led the first wagon trains to the Pacific. I mean, he's absolutely extraordinary. His name, his nickname is Broken Hand because of a terrific rifle incident, I think, where it blew up his hand. So yeah, Thomas Fitzpatrick is absolutely extraordinary. He was one of these furriers for 20 years, and then he was a scout. And then, as I said, he led wagon trains through the Rockies and across to the Pass, through the South Pass and across to the Pacific. And he would have had an awful lot of dealings with the Native Americans, which is perhaps where his legend falters slightly, in that he believed they should be dealt with fairly, but he didn't necessarily think that they should be treated equally, which...
Well, that would have been typical of his times. But
yeah.
he was also completely opposed to the reservation system, for example,
yes.
and was thought very highly of by,
yes,
Native, American
by the Native American
nations.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Indeed.
Yeah.
A very, very colourful Irish woman. There are a number of colourful Irish women, and some of them members of what is euphemistically known as the oldest profession. Incredibly colourful in the American West. One who was not a member of said profession, very colourful, was Belinda Mulrooney.
Yeah, I think Belinda was probably the opposite of the oldest profession, actually. She would have had no truck with that sort of thing at all. Belinda is an absolutely extraordinary character. She's from Sligo, isn't it?
Mm.
And again, she followed her family across when she was about 13. She'd been thrown out of school in Ireland for fighting with the teacher, and she was thrown out of school in America for fighting with the other children who were mocking her Sligo accent. So again, adding to this rich tapestry of Irish accents that are populating the parts of America that you never really hear about. And Belinda was a serial entrepreneur. I mean, she first off, she bought a little parcel of land and rented it out for a Ferris wheel. And she then opened a sandwich bar, and she was then a stewardess on a steamship going up to Alaska. But she had a little sideline in luxury goods being sold at the ports. And eventually she took her sideline and she moved up to the Klondike, where the gold fields were just opening up. She brought necessities, but she also brought luxuries. Very far thinking lady. So she brought hot water bottles. She brought silk underwear for the ladies that the gentlemen hoped to lure to their beds. And she made a killing. She made an absolute killing. She sold her goods and she opened up a hostel, and she had cots up in the upper floor. And then she kept everybody in line on the lower decks by being formidable, I believe is the word. And apparently she could swear like a sailor as well. And she herself steered clear of all gentlemen. She had her scales weighted in her favour because she was paid in gold dust. And apparently the sweepings on the floor at night would add up to about $100 as well. And she became the wealthiest woman in the Klondike.
She did fall victim to a charlatan in the end, though, didn't she?
She did. Unfortunately, she kept her nose clean for several years, and then Count Carboneau swept her off her feet. I mean, even the name says it all. And she moved to Washington, and they built a mansion, and they called it Carboneau Castle. And sadly for Belinda, he was a swindler, and she ended up cleaning welders in shipyards, and apparently was very happy cleaning welding machinery in shipyards, but sadly not the wealthiest woman in the Klondike anymore.
Finally, Liz, one of the most famous Irish women, if not the most famous Irish woman in America, and that's Annie Moore. And she's famous because she was the first person to arrive at Ellis Island. But her story has been utterly misrepresented.
It certainly has. I'm sure people are familiar with the name, at least. So she was the first person to go into Ellis Island, although supposedly there was a couple of German fellas pushed out the way because she was prettier. And so she anyway was the first emigrant, and she was moving over at the age of 17 with her two younger brothers to join their parents over there. She arrives at Ellis Island to a big fanfare. The local dignitaries are there. She's given a gold $10 coin. She's in all the newspapers. And this is a very exciting moment because it's such an embrace of immigrants to America. It was the 1st of January 1892, I believe, when it opened up. So then her story was sort of followed over the years, that she left New York and went to Indiana, and then she married a descendant of Daniel O'Connell, and then she moved to Texas and ended up settling in Waco and had, you know, an interesting enough life, and then died in an accident. She was hit by a streetcar. Of course, none of this is true, even though the descendants of that lady attended commemorative events related to Annie Moore in Ellis Island. It was, in fact, not the Annie Moore from Cork that we were led to believe. So it was in the noughties, some genealogists started doing some digging and found that Annie Moore, in fact, never left New York, that she lived in the slums, that, you know, she had a really hard life. She married a German immigrant who worked in the nearby fish market. She had 11 children, 6 of them died, and she herself died quite young at the age of 50 and was buried in an unmarked grave. So she had what would have been quite a typical life of a poor Irish immigrant, and not this kind of American dream that we were led to believe. And that to me is really interesting, how the figure was kind of glamorized over time, but actually it really belies that myth of the American dream as well.
Yeah. Let me second guess myself and say that I think probably Typhoid Mary and Mother Jones are even more better known Irish women. Mary Harris.
We had to put Typhoid Mary in there.
You have Mary Harris.
Mother Jones. Mary Mallon had been in there, and we decided to let the woman rest in peace.
Mind you, she wasn't the most innocent herself.
But during a pandemic, do you really want Typhoid Mary?
I suppose. Definitely pandemic influenced omission, no doubt about it. Anyway, thank you very much for talking to us today. Your enthusiasm for the, and they're not all women, obviously, but there's a lot of them, and there's good representation, a fair sprinkling of women. Your enthusiasm is infectious, and I can tell that you both enjoyed putting this together. The book is called Irish Lives in America. It's published by the Royal Irish Academy and is available from their website, www.ria.ie, and all good bookshops. My guests are the editors Niamh Gallagher and Liz Evers. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Miles.
Thanks.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Mark McGrath and Jamie Doyle on sound, and to our researcher, Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer, Lorcan Clancy, goodbye, and thanks for listening.